This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. Back in 2016, a Stanford student athlete named Brock Turner was convicted on 3 counts of felony sexual assault. He had sexually assaulted an unconscious young woman the year before outside a frat party behind a dumpster. He served 3 months of a 6-month sentence in county jail, a sentence many denounced as unreasonably lenient. But that's the part of the story we know. We have known very little about his victim, referred to in court documents simply as Emily Doe, until now. Her name is Chanel Miller. She's 27 years old, a writer, an artist, an advocate, and she has a lot more to say. In an interview with 60 Minutes, she read part of her victim impact statement from the trial against Brock Turner.
I had to force myself to relearn my real name, my identity, to relearn that this is not all that I am, that I am not just a drunk victim at a frat party found behind a dumpster, while you are the all-American swimmer at a top university, innocent until proven guilty, with so much at stake. I am a human being who has been irreversibly hurt. My life was put on hold for over a year, waiting to figure out if I was worth something.
That's Chanel Miller reading part of her victim impact statement on 60 Minutes. Miller recently revealed her identity with the release of her new memoir called Know My Name, and she joins us now from San Francisco. Chanel Miller, welcome to 1A.
Hello, Joshua. Thank you for having me.
Now, we'll be speaking frankly about the subject of sexual assault in this podcast, so if you need to stop and come back and listen later, of course, that's perfectly okay. Also, if you're a survivor of sexual assault and you would like support, there's an organization you can reach out to called RAIN, the Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network. They have a 24/7 hotline. Here's the number, 800-656-4673. So, Chanel Miller, how does it feel to hear yourself called by your actual name, Chanel Miller, after this whole process?
It feels wonderful, really liberating. I've been waiting for it for a long time, and I'm still not used to it, but I love hearing it.
What are you not quite used to?
Just, you know, feeling that little tingle of recognition that this is me and being okay with it. I think for a long time, I refused to accept that I was the person inside this case. It was much easier to try and live a normal life outside of the courtroom and sort of separate my identity inside the courtroom and outside. Outside, I still had friends. I still had things that I loved doing. Inside the courtroom, I was often stripped of identity. I didn't have any characteristic traits. I was extremely isolated, and so that person was someone I didn't want to affiliate with. Now that I've written the book, I've been able to merge those two people, to integrate that entire courtroom experience into the context of my life, and I can exist as a full and authentic person, and I think that's someone that something that everybody wants.
Is that part of why you decided to write the memoir? I imagine that being known as Emily Doe to the public made it easier to kind of, and maybe not, but my presumption is that it makes it easier in some ways to compartmentalize who you are from what happened to you. Was that integration part of what made you decide to write the book?
Yeah, I think I realized, you know, this has been an extremely formative experience, and I'm not ashamed of it. I've allowed it to inform who I am now. You know, I think in the beginning, your instinct is to rid yourself of the experience, to be in denial of it. And I realized over time that you get to decide how the experience lives inside you. You can let it inform you and fuel you. And I've learned to, you know, take away the positive traits that I've garnered from it. You know, I'm more assertive now. I'm self-reliant. I feel confident in where I stand. I'm not afraid to fight for other survivors, and I'm proud of what I've been through. These are the characteristics I take with me, and I'm proud to assign my name to that.
I do want to talk about what happened to you as well as where you are now and kind of the trajectory of your life, where you're heading. Mm-hmm. Talk about when you decided to press charges after this assault, the frat party, everything that happened. I imagine that you had certain impressions of the legal system and what it would mean to navigate that system as a survivor of sexual assault before you were actually in the system. Am I right?
Correct. Yes. Yeah, I decided to press charges within 24 hours of leaving the hospital. I got a call from the detective asking if I wanted to. I said yes, not knowing what the implications would be. I still did not know what the charges even were. After I came home from the hospital, I was left in silence for 10 days. I didn't receive any calls or messages. And one day I went into work and I was checking the news, sitting at my desk, and that's when I learned what happened to me and read about the way my body was found half naked with one breast exposed, my, you know, waist down exposed, pine needles embedded throughout my hair. And that was a surreal out-of-body experience. At that point, I didn't think pressing charges would go anywhere. To me, it was a very clear case. You know, how could that have been a consensual encounter if that was how I was abandoned? I didn't think it would go anywhere, and instead, I found that my assailant was pushing back as hard as he could and would use every resource to try and discredit me and make me go away, but I refused to do that.
You said that you were left in silence for 10 days after the assault. Did I hear that correctly?
Yes.
What were you thinking about during those 10 days?
I mean, I had been told that I was found and that someone had been acting hinky around me. I didn't know what that meant.
Acting hinky?
Yes.
Huh.
I think they were trying to protect me until they knew the facts of the case. They didn't want to give me misguided information, so they were working on their end to clear things up. But I was not given any information to exactly where and how I was found. And so I thought, oh, I had passed out. You know, I'm taken care of now. I can go home. And they told me to, you know, keep living your life. And so that's what I tried to do.
I want to go back to the victim impact statement that was published by BuzzFeed News back in 2016. This is something you read directly to your assailant in court before the judge rendered a sentence. We've heard from some of our listeners about the impact of that impact statement. Lindsay wrote on our Facebook page, as part of our Take Back the Night events at the college where I teach, we did a huge sit-in and read her letter together. It was extremely powerful. Chanel, what were you hoping to convey through this letter?
I had just been muted for so long. Every time you testify, you're only allowed to answer directly to the questions being asked of you. You know, you're not allowed to express emotion openly. You're forced to sit and be even-tempered and calm, to never talk back. And it was a lot to digest. I wanted to convey that I was suffocating, that I was extremely angry, and that I was angry because I was in an immense amount of pain. When you talk about these cases, often we focus on the physical assault, you know, the graphic details of it. I wanted to convey that the aftermath is just as important to add to the calculation of the harm. There's so much emotional and psychological damage that follows these assaults, you know, and I wanted to convey that I've had a nuanced experience that can't be summed up in neat little news articles, that this will affect me forever. That's what I needed them to hear.
We want to play another good chunk of your victim impact statement, but before I do, I wonder what it's been like for you getting some of the responses from people, support and gratitude, and I'm sure it was just kind of, at times, I'm guessing, overwhelming, but what was it like for you to get the reaction to people, the reaction from people to what you wrote?
I mean, absolutely incredible. I don't know if people have realized they are responsible for saving me. There are many times I wanted to give up on myself. Even writing the book, there were days I questioned why I was submerging myself in the past repeatedly. It seemed so unhealthy to be kind of marinating in these really awful memories, but I had received so many supportive letters from people who always just said, all we wish for is your healing. We need you to keep walking for us. And so even on days where I felt like, oh, I don't want to keep going, I knew other people did, and that it would mean a lot to them if I continued to seek out joy and make myself better. And so I did.
Let's play another piece of that victim impact statement, which you read again earlier this year during your interview with 60 Minutes. It's just under 2 minutes long, but we think it's important to play a good chunk of this. So here again is another excerpt of the victim impact statement written by Chanel Miller.
How fast Brock swims does not lessen the severity of what happened to me and should not lessen the severity of his punishment. If a first-time offender from an underprivileged background was accused of 3 felonies and displayed no accountability for his actions other than drinking, what would his sentence be? The fact that Brock was an athlete at a private university should not be seen as an entitlement to leniency, but as an opportunity to send a message that sexual assault is against the law, regardless of social class. The probation officer has stated that this case, when compared to other crimes of similar nature, may be considered less serious due to the defendant's level of intoxication. If felt serious, that's all I'm going to say. What has he done to demonstrate that he deserves a break? He's only apologized for drinking and has yet to define what he did to me as sexual assault. He has re-victimized me continually, relentlessly. He has been found guilty of 3 serious felonies, and it is time for him to accept the consequences of his actions. He will not be quietly excused. He is a lifetime sex registrant. That doesn't expire. Just like what he did to me doesn't expire, doesn't just go away after a set number of years. It stays with me. It's part of my identity. It has forever changed the way I carry myself, the way I live the rest of my life.
That's part of the victim impact statement written by Chanel Miller. Something in that victim impact statement, Chanel, and part of the backstory of all of this has always stood out to me. I was in the San Francisco Bay Area when your case was in the news. I was there before I moved to D.C. And one of the things that I feel like a lot of people kind of grappled with, unfortunately at your expense, was the nature of the criminal justice system. This idea that this all-American kid who was a star swimmer at a big-name university could have his whole life ruined and, oh, he must be lenient, I think kind of slapped a lot of people in the face. At the same time, we were looking at the East Bay, not 30 miles away from Stanford, at unarmed black men being shot in Oakland with no accountability. I wonder what it was like for you being in the middle of this much bigger conversation about law, justice, crime, enforcement, accountability, sentencing, that began as just this very personal assault and became something much, 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 much bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think in these cases, there's so much pressure on the victim to be good. I feel like often people of color have to prove why we shouldn't be hurt. We have to show you that we're human, that we have families, that we have good backgrounds. And I don't like that it often feels like our worth has to be earned, that it's not inherent. And
I'm sorry, Chanel, you said we as people of color. I should have asked you that sooner. How do you identify?
As an Asian American woman.
Oh, gotcha. Great. Thank you. Go ahead. Sorry.
Privilege to me is never being forced to examine your own behavior. I felt throughout the proceedings, Brock was never challenged. He was largely taken care of. He never had to do the work of introspection, you know, to show that he was even interested in reformation. I felt like they treated his act like a temporary lapse in his character, that ultimately he was a model citizen, but this single act should not define him. And that was largely unfair to me.
Could you empathize, though, Chanel, with why people thought that way? I mean, I think that there is this kind of impulse from people where they want to see the best in people. And I think they want to believe that a young man who does something stupid or egregious or criminal, you know, if it comes from certain kind of backgrounds and looks a certain way, might have redemption in his future. I know that's not fair to you, but I wonder how you view that mentality now with the benefit of experience.
Sure. I also believe in redemption. After this happened, what I expected from him was an apology. I was fully ready to hear it and to, you know, receive it and to wish him well. And instead, he fought me actively. He used every tool in the book at me and my family's expense. And so I do believe in people owning up to their actions and vowing to do better. I think that's all you can hope for from these cases, that people actually learn. So what shocked me was that he never showed that he had learned anything. He was in denial throughout the year and a half and never took accountability for his actions and was still rewarded with a lenient sentence. That to me says, you know, he's let off without even doing the work, and that's not okay.
Which I guess plays into also the media narrative around the way that your story was told, right?
Yes.
How much of that rankled you at the time, or was that something you thought about in retrospect?
I just felt like it was so difficult for me to be humanized. You know, his characters were, his best characteristic traits were constantly put on display. I felt like I had to prove that I was someone who was also cared about, that also had a future with things that I wanted to do that were at stake. And it took me a long time to be able to convey that.
I have to say, Chanel, I'm really, really glad that I get a chance to talk to you, because I remember kind of watching your story from the outside and hearing people say, oh my goodness, this poor woman, how will she ever rebuild her life? I'm glad you're telling that story now, and I want to get more into the things you did to rebuild your life, including stand-up comedy. I want to know more about that, and we want to get some more of your questions and thoughts as we continue with Chanel Miller. Her new memoir is called Know My Name. We'll get to more of your comments in a moment. Stay close.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Rothy's. Rothy's are the perfect gift for the woman in your life who is always on the go and loves a good balance of fashion and function. Rothy's are carefully crafted shoes made from repurposed plastic water bottles. They're stylish, available in a wide array of colors and patterns, and fully machine washable. Best of all, they're comfortable and have zero break-in period. Plus, enjoy free shipping, free returns, and free exchanges. Check out their seasonal styles at rothys.com/1a.
I'm Chip Brantley.
And I'm Andrew Beck Grace. We're the hosts of the NPR podcast White Lies, a story about guilt and memory that says as much about America today as it does about the past.
Apple just named White Lies the best true crime show of the year. And if you haven't listened yet, you can binge the entire series now wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks.
Back now to our conversation with Chanel Miller. Her new memoir is called Know My Name. Chanel, you write about how you had to try to keep it together for other people. Try very hard for your younger sister, for your parents, for people working on the case like the detective. Elaborate on that. What was it that made you feel like you had to be strong for all of them?
It was my way of protecting the people I loved. I had this idea that if I could carry it all by myself and keep it under control, that all of that pain wouldn't have to leak out onto them, that I could ultimately spare them from having to feel this. You know, when I see my loved ones in pain, that heightens my own pain. That's almost harder than experiencing it on my own. And so, you know, I had a desire to protect them, and it took me a long time to realize that I couldn't. You know, the first time I testified in the preliminary hearing, I didn't allow anyone inside the courtroom. I insisted on doing it myself, and I ended up, you know, crying uncontrollably and realizing this isn't going to work. If you're going to proceed, you need to learn to ask for help. But that's something that didn't come intuitively. And so, you know, but it's a huge thing that I learned going through this.
Was there a last straw that made you decide to stop protecting people in that way?
I mean, I think I wasn't able to carry on my own. You know, I couldn't get out of bed on my own. I needed people to support me. I needed to show them that I was in an immense amount of pain. And I also needed them to help remind me who I was. You know, when you're inside a courtroom, you know, you feel yourself disappearing. You know, the way you're depicted gets so distorted. You're constantly humiliated. I would step out and I would hardly be able to function. And I would think, wow, what if that's all that I am? This drunk, dumb person. That's how I was being depicted. And, you know, being around loved ones ensured me, no, I have so much more to offer to the world. I'm so much more than that. And that really saved me.
How much did you have to grapple with this idea of being a victim? That V word carries a whole lot of weight. I mean, I'm wondering if part of the reason why you felt you needed to hold that pain in was about some of the stigma of victimization that you have been preyed upon or taken advantage of, or that you need to be pitied, or, you know, that people need to sympathize with you as opposed to someone who's got agency. And how much did just the idea of victimhood as a sexual assault survivor evolve for you?
Yeah, I think, you know, I had just graduated from college when the assault happened. I was working at my first job. I was very proud of myself that I finally had my feet under me. So I refused to believe that my feet had been taken out from under me. You know, I think where it hits you in your life really matters. At that time, independence and self-sufficiency were priorities for me. You know, I was becoming an adult and I wanted to stay on that trajectory and not be derailed by this stranger. Why should he get to, you know, dictate the next few years of my life? I wanted to be in control of my own life, which was not too much to ask. But when you are traumatized, you need to address it. And if you don't, it will eventually catch up to you. So it took me a long time to even come to terms with the word victim. And then once I accepted it, I thought, how do I, you know, sit with this word and live with it in a way that I will be okay.
How did you decide to sit with that word and live with it?
Well, writing primarily helped me. You know, I think as a victim, you go through so many emotional phases. You are often made to feel like you're crazy. You may go through depression. You may have explosive rage. And it took me a long time to not push away those feelings and finally embrace them and, you know, accept them and just say, you know, how could I not have been going through these things given those circumstances? And instead of punishing myself for feeling all of the feelings that come along with victimhood, I just embraced them and said, I realized that so much of my behavior at that time was rooted in a deep pain, and we should be focusing on that pain and how to help someone who's been victimized out of that pain.
I know there are a number of ways that you identify artistically, including through comedy. How did comedy come into your life?
My boyfriend was in business school at the time in Philadelphia. I was living there sort of waiting for the trial to happen. But there was a comedy club and I decided to audition. And I loved it because on stage, you could be inappropriate and wild. You could be angry and make insane facial expressions and just come off as completely nutty. And it's fine and it's wonderful. And people laugh. And in court, it's so silent and stale. There's no windows. There's so much seriousness. The stakes are really high. And it's not a natural habitat for living. So I had to, you know, find these new spaces in the world where there was laughter and ridiculousness and the ability to not take yourself so seriously.
Were you any good?
Yeah. I promise.
No, I believe
I'll post a clip.
I would love to see it. Talk about that moment before you went on stage. I've tried stand up more than once, and let's just say there's a reason I'm doing this right now, why I'm not on stage in front of a mic with people. What was it like for you that minute before you step on stage where they say, please welcome to the stage? First of all, did you go on stage as Chanel Miller? Did you use your real name?
Yeah.
So when they say, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage, Chanel Miller, that last thought before you step on stage, what went through your head, what went through your heart right before you tried stand up for the first time?
Yeah, just like, let's do this. You know, honestly, after testifying, I feel like anything is possible. What's scarier is standing behind courtroom double doors and then opening and walking in silence to the stand, you know, to be grilled on cross-examination. That's what's terrifying. It's so much better to be in the wings in the dark, to have your name called and then hear applause, people yelling out that they love you, you know, stepping into that warmth and having full control over the next 10 minutes. That's what I loved about it. You know, I owned the microphone. You were not going to interrupt me. I was totally in control. I was going to lift the whole audience. I would lead them to different places. I would put them wherever I wanted. And that was so fun and restorative for me to do.
Does that require you to put down some of the pain, the trauma, the anger, the frustration about what had happened to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think I still carry the pain, but it fuels me because I keep reminding myself what I've been through to give me courage for what I do now, even for interviews. Sometimes I get nervous, you know, to get in front of cameras, but I think I've already been through the worst part. This is the wonderful part where I finally get to have my voice heard and to say what I wish and what I feel and what I think. You know, that's so freeing, and you know, I savor it.
We are speaking to Chanel Miller. Her new memoir is called Know My Name. We'll have more with her in just a moment. Stay close.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for listening to the 1A podcast. Please take a moment to subscribe and leave us a rating. That helps other people find the show. And don't forget, you can catch the news roundup at the end of every week.
When it's too cold to go out or too icy to make it out of the driveway, where do you go to find just the right movie, just the right book, just the right show to binge? Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR can help you keep warm and keep up at the same time. Join us twice a week on Pop Culture Happy Hour.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Back now to our conversation with Chanel Miller, the writer, artist, advocate, and author of the new memoir, Know My Name. Let's get to some listener questions. One of our listeners wrote, I feel seen by Chanel. Though what happened to us was different, I'm so thankful for her strength. Chanel, that strength, among other things, kind of allowed you, as you write, to reach this turning point before the verdict and sentencing, where you thought about what happened to you in a larger systemic sense about criminal justice and law enforcement and leniency and the way that victims are treated and offenders are treated. Talk about that shift and where you saw yourself fitting in terms of advocating a better criminal justice system.
Well, I think, you know, I was a quote unquote best case scenario. In these cases, you rarely have witnesses. I had two sober, unbiased witnesses who caught my assailant red-handed. You know, I had all of my evidence collected. He had all of his evidence collected. I got a ride to the hospital in an ambulance to get a rape kit done less than 24 hours after it happened. You know, I did everything a victim is supposed to do when an assault happens, and yet look where it left me. That terrified me that this is sort of the best we can ask for. Then even when you take all of the steps necessary, you're still going to endure so much brutality. You're still going to find it really difficult to exist in the world when the system spits you out again. So I couldn't sleep thinking that I was a victim VIP, right? That this is good treatment. I couldn't accept that. You know, something has to change.
With regard to those changes, California's former governor Jerry Brown signed two bills into law 3 years ago. They create a mandatory prison sentence for the assault of an unconscious or intoxicated person because of your case. Are there other specific changes? Is there maybe like one change at the top of your list that you would also like to see made for dealing with cases of sexual violence?
Yeah, I would love for us to fund rape crisis centers. You know, I was assaulted on Stanford campus. I was taken a half hour south to San Jose because that was the nearest hospital where I could get a rape kit done. You know, even having access to these centers in order to collect evidence in the first place is extremely valuable and vital.
I'm sorry, Chanel, you were raped at Stanford, which is a university
Yes.
that has a gigantic medical school and multiple hospitals that it is expanding. And they
Yes.
had to drive you down to Santa Clara County to get
Yes.
to San Jose to get a rape kit?
Correct.
How the hell
and
is
that
possible? Stanford's medical
Yeah.
school is gigantic and they don't have rape kits on campus?
Yeah. I mean, I woke up extremely confused. I thought I was at Stanford Hospital. So, you know, if you think about something as simple as transportation, how do you get to the hospital? If you're assaulted on Stanford campus, do you call an Uber? You're not allowed to change out of your clothes. You know, you're not allowed to shower if you want to collect evidence properly. So who's going to take you? Do you ask your one friend on campus who has a car? You know, these are very simple things that we don't even think about when we ask a victim to report.
A few more quick questions I'd like to ask you in the time we have left. Let me get to a question from Amy, who emailed, "My daughter was raped in her first week of college and is struggling to come to grips with the trauma. It was, in many aspects, very similar to your experience. It happened over 3 years ago, and we are at a loss as to how to help her. She refuses to go to counseling and is floundering in a self-medicating loop of marijuana and alcohol. Any suggestions would be most helpful." Chanel?
Yeah, I would say just be patient. I think I was going through a lot too that I could not process. I feel like I was on an expedited timeline because I was going through court. You know, the only reason I finally sought out therapy is because I had to testify for the preliminary hearing. I showed up 3 weeks before I was called to testify. I found a therapist and said, "You need to get me ready." You know, I treated her almost like a personal trainer, but I was really forced to process. I would say, you know, the first thing you need to establish for a victim is agency. She's had her agency stripped away from her. So instead of saying, "You need to do this or this," you can lay out options for how to move forward or what to do.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, it is her who has to choose those options because that choice is what she needs.
Finally, I wonder if you are hopeful for the future. I know that the Me Too movement's resurgence has really changed the conversation on sexual assault and emboldened many women to tell their stories just as you have. The nation had a very intense conversation about sexual assault allegations after Christine Blasey Ford testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee about now Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. How hopeful are you that things are changing with that testimony, with more women sharing their stories? Are we moving in the right direction?
I do think we're moving in the right direction, and I do constantly feel hopeful. You know, watching all these women come forward before me propelled me to come forward. They were the ones who showed me that I do have a space in this world, a right to take up space and to be loud, and that encouraged me to become visible. I hope that my becoming visible will help others out there. You know, I know that none of us are going anywhere. You know, we're going to keep fighting. I know that in my bones, and I am so encouraged by all the women surrounding me. And so, yes, I am extremely hopeful.
Chanel Miller. Her new book is called Know My Name, A Memoir. Chanel, I appreciate you talking to us. I look forward to seeing that video of your stand-up, and thanks for making time for us.
Thanks, Joshua.
This podcast was produced by Catherine Fink and edited by Miranda Fulmore. To learn more about the rest of the team, you can visit the1a.org/staff. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.